My name's Will Chapman. I'm a transplant and HPV surgeon at Washington University in St. Louis. Today, we are going to have three presentations, each about 20 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have about 30 minutes for discussion. We've got a couple of cases that Dr. Maynard put together, and then we'll have time for questions for anyone that has topics related questions that you'd like to ask. The overriding theme of the discussion today is operating on patients with end-stage liver disease, and this is really more focused on the non-transplant patient, the non-liver surgery patient that all of us encounter from time to time. Our first speaker, Dr. Aaron Maynard, is going to talk about non-transplant general surgery in the cirrhotic, beware of the pitfalls. Dr. Maynard is a transplant and HPV surgeon in Portland, Oregon. Aaron.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you to the college for allowing me this opportunity to speak today on what I feel is a very important topic, and one that I think no matter what you do, someone at some point is going to encounter a patient with cirrhosis, and the question is what to do with them and how to keep them safe. I do not have any disclosures. So the objectives of this portion of the talk are really to characterize the problem. I'm going to touch very briefly on the physiology of liver disease, some predictors of morbidity and mortality, and touch a little bit on liver decompensation, and then look at two common surgical dilemmas that we'll see: cholelithiasis in the cirrhotic and the treatment of umbilical hernia repairs in the cirrhotic. So some of the difficulties, I'd love to tell you that there's great literature surrounding this topic, but really it's limited to small volume, single-centered retrospective reviews, large volume multi-centered database, which relies heavily on reporting and coding, and then observational data. So the statistics. Why are we here and why do we care? 1 in 10 Americans will have some form of liver disease, so we're all very likely to see this, even non-transplant surgeons. And in 2014, it was the fourth leading cause of death in patients between 45 and 54, and the 12th leading cause of death overall. 75% of Americans infected with hepatitis C actually do not have any knowledge of their disease. 6 million children in the United States have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, so the face of liver disease is certainly changing. And 10% of patients with cirrhosis will undergo surgery in the last 2 years of their life, with an associated mortality of 8 to 25%. Putting the scope of this problem a little bit differently, Dr. Schimmelshaw, one of our co-speakers, put out a nice paper in 2009 in the Journal of American College of Surgeons, looking at the nationwide inpatient sample between 1998 and 2005, looking at cholecystectomies, colectomies, AAAs, and CABG, all of which were elective, and no patients underwent transplant during this hospital admission. They received three categories based on diagnosis code: non-cirrhotic, cirrhotic, and cirrhotics with portal hypertension, based on additional coding of ascites, bleeding, encephalopathy, and renal insufficiency, and looked primary endpoint at in-hospital mortality, but also at length of stay, total charges. There were 2.8 million cases altogether, 23,000 cirrhotics, and 4,200 with portal hypertension. You see that the incidence of operating on patients with cirrhosis and portal hypertension over the time course hasn't really changed. This is the breakdown of cases. Patients for all comers were most likely to have CABG, but in cirrhosis and cirrhosis with portal hypertension, cholecystectomy. And what they find is that the length of stay and hospital cost was statistically significantly higher in patients with cirrhosis and portal hypertension. and mortality, controlling for age, gender, race, and other non-liver comorbid conditions was associated with an increased rate of mortality in cirrhotics as well as portal hypertension, with CABG being the greatest risk of death from liver disease. And I think that the takeaway from this is that just staying out of the abdominal cavity doesn't mitigate your morbidity in patients with cirrhosis. Touching briefly on the physiology of liver disease, I think it's fairly important to understand, especially when attempting to resuscitate these patients postoperatively. Cirrhosis and portal hypertension does lead to splenic and arterial vasodilation through a number of factors, primarily nitric oxide, which decreases the systemic vascular resistance substantially. And I think that this is important to realize because in the patients, especially with increased comorbid conditions in our NASH population, with a relatively normal but low ejection fraction of 50 to 55%, anything that increases their SVR can decrease their ejection fraction. All of this leads to decreased effective arterial volume, leading to activation of the renin-angiotensin system, probably more physiology than anybody wanted to discuss today, but increasing cardiac output, and then all of this snowballs. And certainly, operating on these patients starts this cascade of events and decompensation. Liver decompensation was actually first described by Hippocrates in the 5th century BC. He discussed the association between mental derangements and jaundice. But when we're looking and characterizing decompensation, hepatic encephalopathy, ascites, whether or not it's associated with SBP, variceal bleeding, hyponatremia, hepatorenal syndrome, and hepatopulmonary syndrome. And what this all means, though, is for those patients who present decompensated or have a decompensating event leading to any of these, decreases their median survival substantially. So you take somebody from with compensated cirrhosis with an overall survival of 9 years to someone with type 1 hepatorenal syndrome with a relative overall survival of only 2 weeks. And this is another way to look at that, is that anybody with decompensated cirrhosis has a shortened survival. What are measures of survival? There are two main things that people think about, the Child-Pugh classification that was initially developed, not for a predictor of mortality after surgical procedures in general, but shunt surgery in 1964 at the University of Michigan. It initially included nutritional status, which dropped off in 1972 and was replaced by prothrombin time. But you can see the three classifications with a three-month mortality of Child's A being 4% and Child C without anything done to them, 51%. In 1999, the Mayo Clinic tried to develop something that used more of a continuous scoring system with weighted objective variables to predict death after TIPS. This was modified in 2000 and dropped off the etiology of liver disease, which used to be included, and then subsequently was utilized for liver allocation in 2002. And has been changed to the sodium MEL because we know hyponatremia is an independent predictor of death in those patients with liver disease. But it certainly underscores both small women and their extent of their liver disease because oftentimes their creatinine will not increase to a point to bump their MELD score. And patients with PBC will have relative increased portal hypertension compared to their overall synthetic function. So the MELD can underscore the extent of the liver disease in these two patient populations. So how do these compare when we're looking at general surgical procedures? This is a relatively small review out of the retrospective review comparing the Child's Pugh score versus MELD as a predictor of outcome after elective and emergent surgical repair in cirrhotics between 1999 and 2003, looking at 30-day and three-month, what were considered long-term outcomes were recorded, and looking at the correlation between Child's Pugh and MELD. It was 40 patients, and I think the nice part to highlight about this particular study is actually the breadth of procedures that were done, anywhere from IND to appendectomy, as well as cervical discectomy, so can apply to most people in this room. And looking at the etiology of liver disease was mostly viral, which compares here in the United States. About half of the cases were emergent, 24 were elective. And what they found was, for all comers, a 17% one-month mortality. And I think it's interesting to highlight that's a fairly high mortality, and the vast majority of these patients fall within a MELD of 9 to 16, or a child's B or less, so what one would consider a relatively well-compensated cirrhotic. And when they look at the how these two compare, they actually compared fairly well and correlated better in the emergent setting. I think one of the other observations, which is even more important too, is that many physicians were not documenting child's PU scores. And so it's something that maybe not a lot of people are thinking about prior to operating. They certainly need something easy and less subjective in the emergent setting. So potentially a need for an app. What are some risk factors for mortality after surgery in patients with cirrhosis? There was a retrospective review published in Gastroenterology in 2007, looking at a total of 722 patients. They divided an era of surgery, 1980 to 1990, between 1994 to 2004, to see if we're getting any better at operating on these patients, and looked at patients with a median MELD of 8, so again, very well compensated patients undergoing major digestive, orthopedic, and cardiac procedures. They also had to have associated varices on endoscopy, hypoalbuminemia, INR, or greater than 2 bilirubin. They used controls for cirrhotics that were not undergoing surgery, and then 303 cirrhotics that underwent minor surgeries. And again, this just highlights that the median MELD was 8. Adjusting for age, comorbidities, and MELD, those patients with cirrhosis that underwent a surgery had decreased overall survival at 90 days, but this didn't pan out at 1 year. Predictors of mortality in a multivariate analysis were MELD, age greater than 70, and additional comorbid conditions, but we see that the etiology of liver disease, emergency surgery, and the era of surgery showed no difference. So gallstones and liver disease. This is certainly something that we see most commonly, and part of that is because cirrhotic patients are more likely to have gallstones, and it actually increases over time of liver disease. What differs from the general population is that 25 to 30% of cirrhotic patients will actually have pigmented stones instead of cholesterol stones. It's important to note, though, that the incidence of cholecystitis in cirrhotics, although you're more likely to have stones, is not higher in non-cirrhotics. The reason for these pigmented stones is hypersplenism leading to hemolysis, increased estrogen, and likely gallbladder dysfunction. And it makes the diagnosis of cholecystitis in the setting of cirrhosis certainly difficult and should be a diagnosis of exclusion. When we look at our typical clinical picture of diagnosing cholecystitis, we're thinking right upper quadrant pain, leukocytosis, an elevated bilirubin perhaps, and an AST and ALT. Those are the same clinical findings that you'll see in someone who's presenting with acute alcohol hepatitis. When we're trying to then use our diagnostic studies that we're used to, using an ultrasound, looking for gallbladder wall thickening, gallbladder distension, and pericholecystic fluid, I put two pictures up here, both of explanted livers from liver transplant with no symptoms, one with gallbladder wall thickening and one with a severely dilated gallbladder, again with no symptoms, and many of the patients have cirrhosis. Another thing that can be used for diagnosis is the HIDA scan, and what we see is delayed excretion of the tracer at 50 minutes, so it can be very difficult to use as an adjunct. So let's say you're convinced they have cholecystitis, they're well compensated, and you want to operate on them. Laparoscopic versus open. There was a consensus conference in 1992 looking at laparoscopic cholecystectomy and cirrhosis, and they determined that laparoscopic cholecystectomy was unsafe in the setting of cirrhosis. I would say that we've come 180 degrees since that time. Based on some studies, there was a single center review by Dr. Chavin and colleagues of a relatively small number of patients between 2002 and 2011. And I think the thing to highlight here is though, although the MELD was greater than 15 in some of these patients, the actual thing that drove the MELD was a bilirubin of 2 or greater, but the synthetic function and the INR in these patients was fine. So I think that these patients were likely over-called in terms of cirrhosis. What they found was no difference between laparoscopic and open in terms of cirrhotics and non-cirrhotics and complications rates, EBL, conversion rate, and length of stay. They did see a trend toward more major complications in child C cirrhotics. However, this was not statistically significant. And so the authors of this study concluded that laparoscopic cholecystectomy can be done with acceptable morbidity and mortality in child A and B and should only be performed with great caution in child C cirrhotics. Another look at the nationwide inpatient sample between 2003 and 2006, looking at in-hospital mortality, trying to compare open versus laparoscopic with a secondary outcome of infection, ascites, transfusion, bleeding, and liver failure, looked at a total of 3,000 cholecystectomies. And what you see here is, although you can't report the MELD within the nationwide inpatient sample because of lack of laboratory data, it looks like in the open chole category, these patients were likely sicker from the start with coagulopathy, renal insufficiency, and anemia. But what they saw was, with the intent to treat arm, the open cholecystectomy had increased postoperative infection, transfusion, and liver failure. And when they say, well, shouldn't you just start laparoscopically and convert, are those patients at increased risk? They didn't really see any increased risk in those operations. But I think one of the things to consider instead of lap to open is what about those patients that are too high risk, which is, I think, the vast majority of these patients that come to us. Our typical bailout maneuver is a percutaneous cholecystostomy tube. And there's a nice picture here that makes it look straightforward. The tube goes through the liver. There's no ascites. But what do you do in the cirrhotic patient who has ascites, is increased risk of bleeding? The leak around the area until there's a fistula can cause secondary bacterial peritonitis. And what is your plan for removal? I would ask to consider this option. It's a endoscopic stent insertion into the cystic duct. This is a relatively small study, retrospective review between 1999 and 2004, with a total of 30 patients with a MELD greater than 15, the vast majority child's PU and child C, who had cystic duct stent placed for stone and cholecystitis. And what they found was a very low complication rate with the vast majority of patients doing well. Only 2 had recurrent biliary colic, and there was 1 death related with sepsis that was actually not associated with their event. And so the authors conclude relatively safe, effective, and can offer a bridge to more definitive therapy. It is something that I've used in a few select patients that has actually worked well as a bridge to liver transplantation. Something we've almost all seen here, and I hope everybody's had lunch or is almost ready for it, but is the umbilical hernia. It occurs in 20 to 40% of patients with cirrhosis, and certainly more common in patients with ascites. And what we see is with the increased ascites, we see increased skin tension leading to ischemia, and then ulceration, and then ultimately, if not controlled, leak or rupture. And so the management of umbilical hernias is really dependent on the patient's symptoms, whether or not they have ulceration or ascites. And the real question is when is the optimal time to fix these patients? And certainly, I think ascites control is the mainstay to avoiding surgical complications and recurrence. There are therapeutic challenges when it comes to this patient population in terms of controlling ascites leak, dealing with varices and associated with their umbilical hernia repair. They have associated diastasis. There's a reason that this patient population has an increased rate of umbilical hernias, and there's a lot of redundant necrotic tissue. So I think it's fairly straightforward what to do with the patient on the left in the middle, and they create a more urgent situation. But what do you do with the patient with large volume ascites but still relatively well compensated who has an umbilical hernia? When do you operate on them? And I think this study is helpful looking at, they followed 44 patients with umbilical hernia who were, they operated on a good percentage of them, but the non-operative ones, nearly 50% of them ended up having a complication, whether or not it was incarceration, skin inflammation, or ultimate rupture. And when they look at the patients who did receive an operation, whether or not that was emergent or elective, they were the same when it came to MELD score. But what they found was those patients who came and had an emergent operation on their umbilical hernia were more likely to have a need for associated bowel resection, increased operative time, and postoperative stay, and no change in recurrence. So the authors of this study concluded that because of the high rate of complications in patients with umbilical hernia, and for those patients who undergo emergency surgery have a higher risk of complications, they advocate for medically optimizing these patients early and operating on them earlier. So in conclusion, the cirrhotic patient, I think, represents a very unique and diagnostic and surgical challenge. Understanding the physiology of patients with end-stage liver disease aids in their treatment. And in the emergent setting, future studies should really focus on predictors of futility as to ethically distribute the best utilization of resources and when to just say no.